Now, whom pods destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and I'm joined, as ever, by Graham.
Hello.
And by Derek.
Howdy.
So we're only one more episode away from our 40th anniversary celebration of Star Trek the Motion Picture, and we're going to dedicate this podcast to the development of Star Trek over the 1970s leading up to the production of Motion Picture, because it's quite a journey and it involves two major projects that were quite advanced stages before they were ditched and eventually to become the Motion Picture. I'd like to start at the end of Star Trek TOS. This almost feels like a final episode of Whom Pods Destroy because we're now talking about the end of TOS, because this is a podcast that's become defined by TOS. TOS is obviously cancelled because they thought that no one was watching it. And one of the reasons why they thought was no one was watching it was because they deliberately put it in a time slot where they thought no one would be watching the show. They moved it to Fridays at 9, cut the budget. Roddenberry lost almost all interest in the project and started working on other things, and the show just died a bit of a death. But Graham, they found out shortly afterwards that they were mistaken.
Yes, they were. There was huge interest in the programme, and there was a huge following, a loyal following, and there was lots of complaints that they'd actually ditched it. And what actually happened was that the way it panned out was the fact that they weren't measuring who was watching it properly. And it was a fault of the system that they used back in the 60s rather than a fault with the programme itself.
They went with eyeballs, which is fair. But what they didn't do is demographics, which is a key component of ratings. And they didn't, if they had measured by demographics, then they would have realised that a huge number of young couples were staying at home watching this, and this is a target audience for advertisers, and they would have lapped that up. So the figures, the volume of people watching it wasn't so much inaccurate, but the kind of people who were was a massively valuable demo for advertisers who would have bought stacks of airtime, and they didn't realise this until afterwards, and didn't properly realise it until it eventually went into syndication, was it, Derek?
Well, what I read, I mean, I don't know all the details about it, because even though I'm quite old, I'm not that old to actually watch it first time round. I believe that it was the issue with, they were trying to, the actual company was trying to actually get syndication going, but there was a rule at that time that you could only have, you had to have 100 episodes before you could get syndication. It's very different from now, because now you need just 12 episodes to get proper syndication. And as we know with Star Trek, the original series, it only did 79 episodes. And there was a big writing campaign for people who, obviously big fans, that helped boost it, and I believe the conventions did. But as you said, the demographics was the big thing that hit them. When they actually found out, when they started putting them on late at night and they started doing proper demographics, they found that there were young people who actually had money. And this was the issue when they found out, we've messed this one up now. All these people here, these are the ones we can actually get the advertisers to put the money into our show to keep it running.
And it wouldn't be the first, not the first time, as we'll discover later, not the first time that Paramount executives have made errors of judgment when it comes to Star Trek, as we'll discuss shortly. There was the letter writing campaign at the end of the second season, I forget which one it was, and there were the conventions, and there was a lot of fan activity, and a big part of Gene Roddenberry's days in those years when he wasn't doing lecture circuits, when he wasn't picking up work here and there, was answering fan mail from fans wanting to know when it was going to come back. And a lot of Paramount's time was taken up answering fan mail saying, where is Star Trek and why is it coming back? You've got these two things going on here. You've got one, you've got this new way of measuring ratings, which they've gone, oh, okay, actually, we actually were sitting on a gold mine here. And then you've got this culture that's emerging and a sense of ownership of Star Trek that emerges in this time as well. A sense of ownership that I think in some respects has toxified fan culture in modern times. But that is a discussion for another time, the fact that, you know, fans feel that they should tell Star Trek how to make Star Trek, which I think is absurd personally. Nevertheless, that is an argument for another day. So they decide we're going to bring Star Trek back, and they bring it back as a movie. They want to make a movie, and this is in the sort of like, this is after the animated series, and it's in the sort of like mid 70s. And the kind of movies that are being made around this time, Derek, we're looking at stuff like Planet of the Apes, Soylent Green, dystopian.
Well, yeah, I mean, we had, in the last podcast we did, obviously, Graham was talking about how we were watching, you know, we watched 2001 and how that was a pinnacle of sort of like enlightenment science fiction. And then afterwards, big sort of budget science fiction movies were quite dystopian.
You know, very dystopian.
And it was definitely much to do with the culture of society, or, you know, the Western society anyway, when it was actually quite a bleak time. We had the Vietnam War, we had the oil crisis, and we had, like, terrorism that was going on. There was plenty of those sort of things like that. And the fiction at the time seemed to be emulating the feeling at the time, which is quite similar to what is going on at the moment. And as you said, it was like, it was quite sort of bleak sort of science fiction movies, like the... Omega Men or Soylent Green, as you've mentioned.
You also, Graham, you've got a movie like Logan's Run, which is actually very similar in when it's set up to Star Trek, because it's this utopian civilization in the 23rd century, but of course they're all living under domes and they're all actually hugely oppressed. They're in gilded cages. I mean, like, they have all leisure, but they can't, and they have to die when they're 30. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, really quite powerful imagery going on there. And some cracking Jenny Agutter as well. But, I mean, message-wise, very, very powerful and probably kind of quite negative.
Certainly. And these are big films. These aren't low-budget ones. I mean, there are low-budget ones. THX, of course, as well. Similar themes, but also very, very dystopian as well.
Yeah, and Dark Star, of course, as well, which is a student movie by John Carpenter.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yes.
And really, a sort of natural progression on 2001. But also building into that whole sort of like the sort of post-hippie culture that we get in the 70s. And this is what happens. The people who were hippies in the 60s are now making films in the 70s.
Yes. Yeah, no, there is that kind of sense in the 1970s where, you know, everyone's coming down from their trip.
Hippie culture had soured.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do mark out sort of like the Manson situation as, you know.
Sure.
As being that sort of point where things do.
Parallels. End of innocence, isn't it? Yeah.
Parallels we can draw with what we're going through now, I think, in many ways.
Certainly.
There's also a strong sense of self-loathing going on. Mm. I think we all think that we're all heading to a future that's unpleasant, and you know, we're looking at ourselves and arguing amongst ourselves. I think in the future fiction and a lot of science fiction will reflect those kind of dialogues that are going on there, and I think there's a lot to be drawn from there. So there's an awful lot of negative stuff. There's Silent Running as well, though, in Fenders, which is a gorgeous film.
It is.
It's still quite negative as well.
But also, yes, ultimately, there's a sadness to that movie. Yeah, although it ends nicely, there's a sadness to the movie.
We've always said, we've seen as well, though, the end of the original series, it sort of sees the premise of Star Trek as being a little out of kilter with the times. Here you've got a military operation. And we see it in one of the final episodes, The Way to Eden, where hippies actually come on board and Kirk is the uptight square. And so it's like Star Trek is the program for squares, and we're going into science fiction is going into a different place. It's going into a more analytical period. Looking at the human condition, which is what Star Trek has been doing.
But yes,
of
course,
based on this rather... premise of being the man.
Yeah, but it's saying, you know, what happens is that we make it, and then we're gods looking down on men.
Yeah.
I mean, that's possibly a reason why there are people who don't like Star Trek, in fairness, because they might feel that that's a very condescending position.
Pretty colonial type.
Yeah,
type
way of looking at it, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, it was the age of, well, it was the golden age, the golden generation in America, who were free, the teenagers. It was a teenager time. Colour was a big thing in the sort of, like, you know, the TV series. The tunics that they wore was very colourful. The sets were very colourful.
Yeah, but we don't have to sell colour TVs anymore.
We don't.
Everyone's got one, yeah.
Everything's brown.
Well, that's it. That's it. When we go into the 70s, everything starts, the colour starts
brown,
to mute.
Man.
Yeah.
Or Soylent Green.
Yeah, Soylent Green. And, yeah, you can actually see the actual way the colours of movies actually change, actually, during the 70s. When it does actually start, we hit that low point when we're coming down from the high of the hippie sort of generation. Everything, the muted colours that you see in a lot of films of that time, it's a fashion as well. I mean, people use...
Yeah, and it's also what's available to you. So, well, look, we can adjust the colour palettes of our movies now because we've got better technologies, we can create richer movies. And yeah, so we're going to we can make darker movies. Not everything has to be in Technicolor anymore, or be noir. You know, we can be a little bit more subtle.
Yep, Star Wars is a muted palette. There are lots of browns in that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's absolutely gorgeous as a consequence. And same with Close Encounters of the Third Kind as well.
But when the colours do come
in. Well, that's right. It suddenly becomes this absolutely vivid, beautiful film. But in many ways, it is this kind of really washy, sort of 70s, you know, slogging movie that... I mean, it's not slogging in that it's hard to follow or anything like that. It's a wonderful, wonderful narrative to it. It's a Spielberg film because it just skips along really, really nicely.
What does it do with Normalis?
Normal life. Yeah, it's taking a very, very boring man and putting him in this really, really unlikely situation. So you've got this is the landscape, and suddenly, and then you've got these Paramount executives, the guys Michael Eisner and Jeff Katzenberg, and they're scratching their heads and saying, we need to drop Star Trek back into all of this somehow with its very, very different message.
Because you were saying that when they brought them back, there was originally going to be the idea of a movie.
Yeah, that was.
Was it going to be TV movies? This is where I'm getting a bit.
So the next move for the first project was a film called Planet of Titans, and this was going to be made in England, and and they'd gone some way. In fact, they were very, very close to production of it before they changed their mind. And a lot of the sketches that you see of Ralph McQuarrie, sketches of the Enterprise, that are very, very similar or have strong echoes with the Discovery. You know those ones that I'm referring to? You suggested that actually they almost looked a little bit like Klingon D7s.
They do, yes, yeah. Very much.
Those are Ralph McQuarrie, who obviously went on to do Star Wars, and the production designer for this project was a gentleman called Ken Adam. And if you know your James Bond films, then you know Ken Adam. In fact, if you're a James Bond fan, then you're a Ken Adam fan, because he was a production designer pretty much from Dr. No all the way up to Moonraker?
Moonraker, definitely, yeah.
I think For Your Eyes Only, one of the reasons why that film took a right turn was because they didn't use Ken Adam. You know, he's an absolute legend, and you were singing his praises in our last podcast, and he would have been on this. So there's a parallel universe out there where this movie is made. And the whole aesthetic is guided by Ken Adam, and I, for one, am tremendously excited by that idea. Although obviously, it never happened.
Yeah, it's a shame that it never happened. But in my head, it's beautiful.
It's beautiful. It is beautiful.
I did read about the actual storyline for this, which was there were two British writers. The storyline was actually quite dystopian in its outcome in the end anyway, and it could have killed the franchise.
I mean, it's interesting because they obviously clearly had no idea about franchises, and that franchises really kind of hadn't been invented. They were just going to make a Star Trek movie. They didn't think about maybe making two or three Star Trek movies. They were going to make one. And no, the conclusion of the movie is a kind of twist, a bit of a Planet of the Apes style twist going on there. And I won't go into it because, I mean, you can read it, and you may not have read the story, but I mean, anyway. But I don't think they had Spock on board for that at this point. I think they might have had Spock on board, Nimoy, on that one, but they didn't for subsequent ones. Anyway, it's a little bit disjointed, but what happened next was they were this close to starting production on this movie. They had a script, two British guys, directed by Philip Kaufman. If you know your Indiana Jones movies and your 80s movies, you'll know who Philip Kaufman is. And then they just went, actually, guys, we're not doing this anymore. And the story goes that apparently what had happened is that they'd seen Star Wars, and they went, we've blown it, lads. Because this movie was only going to get made for about $5 million, which even then is still pretty low budget.
Yeah.
They saw that, and they thought, oh, we've blown it. They said, that could have been us. We could have made that movie. Oh, well, forget it.
And so all the money was coming in for that as well. So
they assumed that would be that. They didn't realise that actually this was the beginning of a new genre of science fiction, and not the end, and not just another movie. And so they said, well, look, there's no point in doing another Star Trek movie, because the audience isn't going to be there. They've seen Star Wars. So they decided to make a TV show instead, and that was Phase 2.
And this was linked with the new channel that they were bringing?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
So Paramount were going to launch a new channel in much the same way that they did when they launched UPN back in the 90s and got commissioned Voyager to be the flagship show for that channel. Star Trek Phase 2 was to be that. And they got almost everybody back, with the exception of Leonard Nimoy, who was not getting on with Gene Roddenberry, and felt that he was owed money from the previous Star Trek. And so they constructed a new setup and commissioned about 8 or 9 episodes, one of which was an episode called In Thy Image, which is the pilot episode. And away they went, and they started building up that as well. And it became weeks away from production before the plug was pulled.
The only thing I really know about Phase 2 is the little clips you've got of the footage that was actually filmed, which seems really really quite freakish when you watch it, because it looks like original series just updated a little bit, and of course the whole links in with the first season of Next Gen, which seemed to go on from there, and of course what happened in motion picture as well. It would have been very strange. I mean, I'm sure it would have been a success at the time, but would it have been a continuing success? We saw it comes out the same. It would have come out around the same sort of time as Battlestar Galactica, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I guess it probably.
So
would have
it would have probably been right up against that.
Mm. Well, Battlestar Galactica took its leave from Star Wars.
Yeah,
yeah.
And
that's a kind way of putting it.
Yeah, but yeah. Then again, you're going to end up with two space operas on at the same time, aren't you? Mm. Which could be good. It could actually develop the strength from that. Yeah, how long did Battlestar Galactica last for? How many episodes was that?
Oh, well, one season, so 24, 25 episodes.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
yeah.
So, and the second season was basically, yes.
Yeah,
we had other TV series like Buck Rogers and stuff like that, mm. sort of around that sort of time, didn't we?
But this is probably just sort of slightly before then, I think.
So it would have stolen a march on all of that.
It would have come out before all of that had happened.
So from what I...
And it would have had the name there as well.
Yeah.
So it would have had that instant appeal.
Absolutely,
that's what the thing why about bringing back Buck Rogers is that did have a name, and that was feeding on the success of Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Because with the success of Flash Gordon, people were looking back at the Buster Crab stuff and the fact that he did Buck Rogers.
Star Wars comes along and goes, what properties do, and everyone else is going, what properties do we have where we can cash in on this?
Yeah, exactly.
Flash
Gordon
and Buck Rogers, yeah.
Yeah, and you see, if you've got that there, then we're going, great. I mean, what they did with Battlestar Galactica was quite brave, is actually coming and say, right, okay, well, we'll create something not new, because they were just basically taking everything that was out there already and just muddling it around to come up with something. It's like, oh, look, this has got spaceships in it.
Yeah, it's got fighters. It's going to be like watching Star Wars.
It's going to be on your telly every Thursday night. Come on,
I first saw it in the cinema.
Well, yeah, they did cinematic releases.
But it was a TV movie. Wasn't it?
So I mean, what you're suggesting is that what they've done is they've gone right. Okay, so we need to cash in on this somehow. We don't make a movie, but we'll make a TV show instead.
Yeah,
and it's which again, and we did see that happening in other networks as well. So that would have been an interesting battleground going on there. When Motion Picture was made, Gene Roddenberry, after Motion Picture was made and it came out, Gene Roddenberry for the sequel, Gene Roddenberry was pretty much kicked off. And also, this is slightly different, but when TNG came out, it's well known that the first two seasons of TNG were difficult productions, and you can see that on the screen. But as Roddenberry's and his people and his team's influence on the show waned, the show frankly got better. I wonder whether or not maybe what might have happened is that we would have had a first season of Phase 2 which would have been in the same vein as Season 1 TNG or as Motion Picture is, and then the networks would have gone, this isn't working out, we need it to be a bit more fun, we need a little bit more action, a bit more adventure. So I wonder whether or not Roddenberry in time would have been eased out, and the TV equivalent of Harve Bennett, who I believe is Harve Bennett, would have been brought in. Because Harve Bennett's a TV guy, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds an extremely plausible.
Yeah. Wouldn't it have been amazing if, like, the first episode of Season 2 of Phase 2 would have actually been called The Wrath of Khan?
Yeah.
And they rebooted it.
In modern times, Khan would have been the story arc for the whole of Season 2.
I know. I mean, there's part of me that thinks, oh, wouldn't it be great to be able to remake all that stuff? I don't think we're really there.
Aren't they doing it on YouTube? Isn't that what all that fan stuff's about?
Fan fiction aside and all of that stuff. I don't think I've seen any of that.
Well, funny enough, I found out that that one of the fan fiction ones, I think it's a Star Trek Continues, which is called Phase 2, because I was actually looking around for on YouTube videos for Phase 2, and I found all of that stuff. But one of them, I think, yeah, the Phase 2 people, Continues, bought the costumes from the TV series, the Phase 2 TV series. They bought the ones that were used in...
The guy who runs those Phase 2 ones is not... There's two really good ones, and there's that guy here, and he's the guy who's recreated the whole set, of the TOS Enterprise, which actually now is the CBS license, and they do tours there and stuff like that. He's based in Ticonderoga. He initially used Phase 2, but then was kind of discouraged away from doing that. So that in a way, that legacy kind of moves on. It kind of lives on. What happened was that while they were developing this show, Roddenberry worked with Alan Dean Foster and his assistant John Povill and Robert Goodwin to develop this outline of episodes, some of which made it into other episodes. If you remember The Child, season 2, mm-hmm. TNG, and if you remember Devil's Due,
I remember
which
that
had her off Tales of the Gold Monkey there, which is a really, really good episode. Both of those episodes are originally commissioned for Phase 2. So they were done. And of course, so did In Thy Image. In Thy Image was mostly penned by Alan Dean Foster. But it is, there's elements of an episode called Robot Returns, I think, which is from a Roddenberry TV show called Genesis 2, which may not have been actually commissioned. I think there was a pilot made of that. And John Meredith Lucas's The Changeling, which we discussed in a previous recent podcast as well. And they all came into there. And when they went to a meeting with Katzenbergen and Michael Eisner to pitch In Thy Image as the pilot episode, what they didn't realise was that by this point, Katzenberg and Eisner had already decided that they were not going to go ahead with this TV show anymore.
Was it a case of not going ahead with the TV show or the channel?
It's both.
Or both, yes.
It's both. Mm. So what had happened was that they were looking for a feature film for the motion picture. One, because they were wrong about Star Wars being the be-all and end-all, that there was still a tremendous appetite for a cinema on for science fiction cinema, because they went and saw Close Encounters and went, see, this is closer to what we can do.
Yeah,
this is more like it. And so they said we should do a feature film. And also running alongside that, they were still trying to get the advertisers for this new network that they were setting up, and they had failed. But the thing is, they were still going through the fairly protracted negotiations with different advertisers, conversations with advertisers, so they couldn't actually say that they wanted to do a feature film for Star Trek. Instead, they were still leading with Star Trek Phase 2 as part of their sales bump, but they were at this point had almost abandoned any hope of being able to launch this channel. So there was a period of about 4 weeks in which everyone was carrying along nicely, thinking In Thy Image has been greenlit, we have a pilot, we're good to go, and money still being spent, people still working ferociously towards this thing. And then at that point, and then shortly afterwards, it was announced, look guys, I'm sorry, we've actually cancelled the show. And they had cancelled it a month earlier, and it was still in production.
So they
very
still,
strange.
They were still creating the sets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Still getting ready to go.
Yeah,
not even Roddenberry, I think, knew. And then this happened, and they went, okay, we're pivoting now to movie and everything. So all that work... A lot of that work obviously gets carried over into the motion picture, but a lot of that work just never gets sees the light of day. And it's a disaster for David Guetrou, the actor who plays Zon. He was the guy who was due to play Zon.
Yes.
Who was Spock's replacement.
Yes.
And he was even signed up even for the motion picture. He was going to be in the motion picture as well. But we'll talk about that in another podcast. But it was... So, it was a bad scene for a lot of people.
Yeah, his fate is actually quite a metaphor for Phase 2, isn't it, really?
you could say.
Yeah.
Happy to say he went on to have a great career as a stage actor, and, I mean, you know, hats off to him.
I've seen an interview with him, and he seems very positive about the whole experience. And I'm sure he does a lot of the convention circuit as well. And I'm sure that's
absolutely
a good income source for him.
And if you're a professional actor working in the television industry, you don't believe anything's happening until you're on set.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
I mean, you just don't. So and he signed a contract anyway. So,
well, he
I mean,
said
I'm
that
sure
he signed a contract for like seven series.
So he probably got a payout, a decent. and pay out for it. So I'm sure it's fine. But obviously, he had an opportunity, to go into an area.
What happened about the other characters? Because I've seen you've mentioned about the sort of there were some sort of scenes at the test scenes, weren't there?
Yeah.
Of because they had one with the actor who plays Zon in there. It's a little bit with him in a sort of traditional Star Trek uniform. And then you have Ilea, the actress who plays that, who
Persis Kambata, in a very traditional original series as well.
She was actually going to be up in the
so
series.
So she was there anyway, that's right. So that's it. I don't think they cast Stephen Collins as Decker.
Ah, okay.
And the idea with Decker was that actually eventually he would replace Shatner. I think the feeling was, I've got this book here, gents, for listeners. It's called Star Trek Phase 2, and it's written by Judith and Garfield Reece Stevens. So that's my source material for it. The idea with Decker was that initially he would act as XO and play like a kind of Riker-like character, doing all the fun stuff while the somewhat older Kirk, oversees things. And the idea was actually the possibility was that Shatner's wage demands were so high.
Waste demands.
That Shatner's money, Shatner was asking too much money, was being paid too much money, and they might have to replace him. So they have a season with Decker, and if it got for another series, and if they wanted to, depending, then they would replace him and kick Kirk to the curb, give him that promotion. We don't know, of course, whether or not that would have happened at all. It may not have worked out like that at all. But these are all speculations that they had. But it's interesting because obviously, you've got the genesis there really of Star Trek TNG, really. And there's a memo that John Povel wrote that I won't go into in too much details, but it's a sort of bit like a kind of talking to other writers and saying this is the ethos of the show, and it could be like this is TNG.
Yeah.
This TV show, I think, was what TNG became.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite gratifying that Roddenberry got the chance to actually make that show, but I think it's also significant that show had problems in its first two seasons as well.
Yeah, and you see that in the development of those characters specifically that came from phase two. So you've got Data instead of Zon.
Yeah.
You've got Riker
instead of Decker.
Instead of Decker there. And Troy, instead of Ilea. And so, and you see the way that those characters develop or don't develop at all.
Mm.
And with Riker, he's pretty much
Kirk Jr.
Yeah, and he's pretty much pointless throughout most of it, isn't he? And becomes he becomes sidelined, doesn't he?
Loving your TNG takes.
Yeah, well, he is an absolute pointless character, isn't he?
He is until we get to the Klingon episode in the first series.
There were some fun episodes that he does. Yeah. He does. They do give him some good. I mean, one of my favourite TNG episodes is Frame of Mind, in which they really put him through the ringer there, when he's captured and mentally tortured, and that's a lot of fun.
Mm.
But you're right. The character really doesn't move that far forward. I mean, we have Best of Both Worlds, don't we? In which he's examining his career. But really, that's almost the writer saying, "Really, what is the point in you?"
Yes.
Why are you here? And literally, why are you here? You should be running your own place now. You should be doing your own series right now. But you're not strong enough a character to have your own series.
No. And in many ways, Troy has that sort of arc as well. But at least Troy sort of develops more into Picard's right-hand man, really.
Yeah.
Because she's the one who goes on first contacts and things like that. And is the most important one there because of her gifts and it goes well into Star Trek sort of like diplomatic sort of bent, but it really becomes the underpinning of the whole of TNG.
Yeah, it's all very 80s with counselor. Right, that's fine. But then she becomes a diplomat and Face of the Enemy where she becomes a Romulan.
Oh yes, that's
brilliant. Spy episodes are always great. Spy stories are always great, and Deanna is superb. I mean, Marina Sirtis. She almost got cut after season one.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine it.
Only because Denise Crosby quit.
Yeah,
that she hung on because they wanted to keep another.
But of course, Data is the one who goes through the biggest arc, and really when he's introduced, he's just the robot, isn't he?
But of course,
he's the one the writers really get hold of and decide, okay, we can really explore this.
Yeah.
This is something we can really get sink our teeth into.
And so this is where Zon could have come into it, because he could have had a really good sort of like.
But then he comes with the whole Vulcan. Baggage.
And he would have been, guy's not Spock. You're the guy who's not Spock.
Yeah.
I think
you ain't my dad.
But also, it's very interesting because the relationship between man and machine is played out. And the big sci-fi and Star Trek trope of the relationship between man and machine, man and technology.
And humanity.
I should say humanity and technology, forgive me. Between humanity and technology is played out in Data. He is the android who wishes to be, you know, human, and we get all of that go through there, and he's a perfect vessel for that. And we wouldn't have had that, I don't think, to the same effect
with Zon.
But they got, you know, good writers in there, and it could have had a really good chance, but it didn't happen.
You know, I mean, we were all blissfully unaware that this stuff was actually going on in the UK, you know, for these sort of series as you know, during the sort of like late 70s and stuff. And
yeah, well, I mean, I think if we'd maybe been following, maybe in Starlog or Starbuck, stuff like this would have come out.
Yeah.
And it would have been, because it was so close to happening that there would have been, I mean, yeah, we didn't have the internet, so I mean, we wouldn't have been that. It might not have happened if we'd had, but it would have reached a point where they've gone, well, you can't cancel it now. It's just that there was still it still wasn't a franchise. Star Trek wasn't a franchise. So it didn't necessarily have that scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it did, because it had the big fan movement, and the letters still kept coming in. So anyway, it didn't happen, and so they moved on with the motion picture, and that's going to be the subject of our next podcast. Next time we get together, it will be in November, and that will be the 40th anniversary of this movie, and we will have a reasonably lengthy discussion about this film, about its genesis.
That's a different film.
And about its impact, and also, you know, about how there are some of us who think it's a great movie and some of us who perhaps don't. But it will be an opportunity for me personally to sit and watch this movie again with a view to recording a podcast about it.
I can see you in your bath with your scented oils and those little candles that float on top of the water.
Derek, I have warned you time and again to stop hacking my bath webcam.
and just for the listeners, what version of the motion picture are we watching before?
Well, I mean, if you want to come read along with us, listener, then my advice would probably be to try and get hold of a copy of the 2000 director's cut. But if not, then the original theatrical version will be just fine, which is the most common version. But there is the 2000 director's cut. I would encourage both of you chaps to try and watch both, if you can, if you have it.
Okay, I'll have a look.
Nothing terrible will happen to you if you don't watch.
Okay.
I can assure you, you won't get caught dry by going, I can't participate in this discussion because I didn't see the 2000 director's cut.
There's plenty of episodes of podcasts where I've done exactly that.
Well, shoot. Okay, all right, fine. We'll leave it there. So thank you very much indeed for listening, listeners. And thank you indeed for podcasting, podcasters.
Thank you very much, Terry.
And until next time, from myself, Terry, and from Derek, and from Graham, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.